Good morning. I need only take a few minutes to tell you in words what you already know through deeds. This has been a most beautiful, beautiful class. It came together as a tremendous surprise to me. It came together through pure demonstration, but it has remained pure demonstration throughout. And I feel that a tremendous message has gone onto these tapes and into your consciousness. Primarily, the purpose of my entire trip, that which started with the work in Honolulu, has been continued here and is fulfilled in this class. It was given to me to make this trip, and a trip which is to cover 9 full months of this particular work, for the specific purpose of making it clear to every Infinite Way student that our major principle is God expressing itself as individual being, your being and mine, not you expressing God, not you reflecting God. Never make such a mistake in this work. You are never the doer. You are never the actor. God is forever expressing itself as the fulfillment of its own being, and God appears as the life of man, woman, child, animal, vegetable, and mineral. Regardless of the fact that we falsely entertain a material concept of that life. However, the infinite nature of God means that there can only be one life. And that life is God expressing itself as life in infinite form and variety, or as infinite form and variety. With this as your first principle, the very moment a person appears to you of an erroneous nature or suggesting an erroneous condition of health, of supply, of employment, of human relationships, you instantly realize, no. God expresses itself as individual being, and regardless of all appearances, regardless of the degree of mortality that is presenting itself to my eyes and ears, whether it is the criminal or the insane or the dying or the dead, regardless of all appearances, God alone is. God alone is the entity and identity of all being. Once you have made this clear within yourself, you then can say, but what about appearances? Remember, in our work, you don't deny appearances. You don't deny anybody or anything. You don't deny the body. You don't deny disease. All you do is, after you have realized God as infinite individuality, infinite being, infinite body, the only law, the only presence, the only activity, the only actor, the only beer, then you can say to yourself, but what about appearances? Then you can smile, because now you have the point in the message of the infinite way, which is responsible for my whole 30 years of work. That is the realization that all evil, whether it appears as a person, as a condition, as a place, or a thing, all evil is nothing more nor less than the activity of the carnal mind, or mortal mind, or devil. It operates mesmerically to appear as person and condition. But regardless of that, it is only the carnal mind in action. Now, in that, you have taken three-quarters of the step toward healing. You have impersonalized it. You have removed it from the person who has appeared to you. The final step is realizing, did God make the carnal mind? Did God make anything destructive to its own creation? Did God create any law, any being, any power, anything, anywhere, anytime, that could end up by destroying his creation? And of course, now you can go back to God again. God is infinite intelligence. God is divine love. Well, that throws out all possibility of God ever having created anything destructive to itself. And there is no other creator. The infinity of God makes God the only creative principle of the universe. And so you see now, you can take the carnal mind and say, thou hast no power. No power. And all your activities are nothing. Actually, what are they? Well, this universal human mind or mortal mind has no real existence. What it is the belief in good and evil, and we have just given it the name carnal mind. Actually, there is no mind to be called carnal. But there is a belief, and you and I are entertaining it in differing degrees, and the people outside are entertaining it completely. They have been born into religions which teach not only the reality of good and evil, but that from time immemorial, evil has been battling God, and God hasn't won out yet. Evil still continues. In all religions outside of the infinite way, there are two powers, that of God and devil, that of immortal or mortal mind, that of Satan or carnal mind, and these are imbued with power which God has to overcome, but so far hasn't in 7,000 years of recorded history. And very likely he's going to. At least we are right if we give up hope in that direction. Now, I will try to make it clear to you how this revelation was given to me. My only concern, and the only thing that ever started me on a search for truth, was not any great sins or diseases or lack in my own life. I was normally human, good and evil, but not to such an extent that I was looking for a God to get me out of it or a religion. My search began on my very first European trip. My interest perhaps was before that, but the real search began on that trip, when I witnessed the poverty in certain foreign countries, when I witnessed the lack of freedom, when I witnessed this thing of a rich class and a poor class, and the poor class never really having the opportunity to get out of it. that opened my eyes, and then on that very first trip, the British Navy and the German Navy were lined up against each other in the North Sea, about to start World War I. This is 1909. Incidentally, this is my 50th anniversary as a traveling salesman. Now, the war didn't start because cool heads prevailed, and King Edward VII made a visit with his family to the Kaiser Wilhelm II over in Germany, which was a sort of a, I apologize, cousin, let's make friends again. And the Kaiser was his ruffles went down, and everybody became happy again. But we who were making those European trips and were aware of what was going on in Europe knew that World War I was just around the corner from October 1909 or November, right on. We knew it was coming, and actually, we were given the date, my firm was, on December 31st, 1939, when World War I was to begin. We knew 6 months ahead when it would begin, and were given plenty of time to prepare. 39? No, excuse me. 1939. Did I? I'm sorry. 1913, December 31st, 1913, I had the date when the war would start in 1914. Now, if you can think with me a minute, a youngster brought up in a country with no thought of war, no thought of wanting anything that any other country had, brought up in a country where they were only too happy to share when other countries were in trouble. This puzzles you, and eventually, just to shorten this greatly, eventually it dawned on me that all of this was going on in spite of churches on every corner, in spite of people who went to church to pray, in spite of people who believed in God. And that set up the wondering in me. And so, as this search continued, I learned that in the earliest days, men fought battles with their fists. And then came bows and arrows. And of course, they were able to destroy the enemy who had only fists. And then came spears, and they could wipe out others. Then came guns, and of course everybody with bow and arrow was killed. And so in each succeeding generation, a greater power has been discovered, and always the greater power destroyed the lesser power. Well now, if that's the secret of life, you just have to go on getting more and more power so as to surprise the other fellow. And then it came to me, that cannot be the solution. And people going to God are only doing the same thing as if they were looking for an atomic bomb. They're going to God to destroy some lesser power. They're looking on God as if it were a great big nuclear bomb, and it can wipe out our sins and our diseases and our this and that. And that's just the asking for a great big power to destroy a lesser power, but it's never happened in all these years. God has never entered the human scene to help mankind. The Hebrews, of course, thought God did when they prayed to God to destroy their enemy, and then they went out and destroyed them. Of course, God did it for them. And in our modern days, I'm sure that most of the people in the world actually believe that it was God who helped us defeat the Germans in two wars and the Japanese. You can't believe for a minute that God destroys any part of its own creation, not for any purpose. Then came the revelation. As long as you are seeking for a great power to destroy a lesser power, you are seeking for something in the realm of effect. Ultimately, and of course this didn't happen in the few minutes I'm telling it to you, it happened over years, the realization dawned that Jesus had said, resist not evil. Put up thy sword. And then I thought, now here's a strange thing. When I was, 19. When I was 19 and had never in my life known anything of a Christian teaching, in fact, had never known anything of any teaching except the Ten Commandments, but my entire family background is Hebrew. But when I was 19, the voice said to me, find the man Jesus and you will have the secret. And from that minute on, my life has been dedicated to that man Jesus and his secrets. And the secret that he revealed is that you do not use one power to destroy another. Pilate, thou hast no power over me. He didn't use any magical tricks over Pilate. He didn't fight back at Judas. He didn't call on God to heal any of those who came to him. Always he indicated, this thing that you're suffering from has no power. What did hinder you? Rise. Open your eyes. And then it was that the secret revealed itself to me. In the moment that you do not use physical or mental resistance, a transcendental presence or power comes into effect in your consciousness. It's there all the time. It's always there. You have, every individual has enough power within themselves to live eternally, immortally, harmoniously, and abundantly, but they have to learn to live that way without taking thought. In other words, then, the moment that I recognize God as infinite life, omnipresent life, remember, that life which I am and which you are. And then the minute I realize that all of this evil that comes to my eyes and ears is only the projection of this belief in two powers and actually is not a person or a condition, then my fears have dropped, and I can get quiet inside and be still. And in that stillness, something takes place of which I'm not aware. I can't feel it, see it, hear it, taste it, touch it, or smell it. I merely know that I'm in a calm. But that calm is the presence of this transcendental something that dissolves those erroneous pictures. It doesn't heal disease. There isn't any. It doesn't reform sinners. There aren't any. It dissolves that belief in good and evil. And once that's dissolved, you're no longer seeing through a glass darkly. You are seeing face to face. Now, on this trip, this is the mission that has been given to me, to reduce this to just these few principles, so that those who have a background of the Infinite Way message and have already attained in some degree the transcendental consciousness, the Christ consciousness, they now, by practice, will fully develop themselves to where They need only indulge a few minutes of contemplative meditation. Now, contemplative meditation is what I have been doing here for you right now. It is, with eyes open or closed, starting with the word God, closer to me than breathing, nearer than hands and feet. I and my Father are one, here and now. Place whereon I stand is holy ground, for I and the Father are here. God is my life, my mind, my soul, my being. God is the only law operating in and through my consciousness. God's being is my being. I can be at peace. God governs, God maintains, God sustains its own creation. God is the law. I need not fear what mortal man can do to me. I need not fear what mortal mind can do to me. I need not fear what infection or contagion or heredity can do to me. I need not fear any of the material or mental powers that be. For I and the Father are one, and the omnipresence of God is my robe. Into this nothing can enter that defileth or maketh a lie. No universal belief, no activity of the carnal mind, nothing of any nature which the world calls destructive, because I know that the omnipresence of God means the nothingness of the carnal mind and all of its activities and all of its so-called history. I know that it doesn't operate as a person or thing. I know that it only operates as a belief in two powers, and I don't have that belief. I have accepted God as the one power. Now, that is my contemplative meditation. Now I'm ready for meditation. Now I'm ready to speak, Lord, thy servant heareth. If for 5 seconds you are in perfect stillness and then thoughts come, stop your meditation. That 5 seconds of meditation was enough. If the silence lasts 10 seconds, be grateful. If thoughts start, stop your meditation. The day will come when you will think it's 5 seconds, but when you look at your watch, you'll find it's a minute. And then you'll understand why it was said that a half a moment of silence would reveal heaven to us, and it will. It'll reveal harmony. It'll reveal harmony. Wholeness, completeness, perfection, always in a degree, because, like Paul, none of us can claim yet to have experienced the fullness of the stature of manhood in Christ Jesus, except that in moments of illumination or complete inspiration or instruction, it does happen. It does happen at times that we attain the fullness of Christ's realization and are completely unaware of physical body. It's a rare occurrence. It's even more rare to those who are not far along on the path, but it is rare even to those who are far along on the path. But it comes more and more frequently the further and deeper we go into meditation, primarily the more that we come to the realization that God is the only power and we need not fear any condition of humanity. You can understand how radical that is when at the present time you have to say to yourself, I even mean that I don't fear an atomic bomb. or a whole mess of them. For none of these things can come nigh my dwelling place. Well, if you come to that place, you're close to there where the fullness of realization can sometimes come in. So please remember this. Never start your day and never start a treatment or a meditation without first bringing to your conscious remembrance God as the All. Now, you know, it may not come in just the way I gave it there. It can come in a thousand different ways. I'll just give you one other illustration that right now is coming through. You all know about material laws, laws of matter, which, of course, include infection and contagion, germ theory, food, climate, weather. And you all know about mental powers, which include hypnotism, mesmerism, suggestion. In fact, you have all had experience with those, because I doubt if there are very many here who have not received treatments which were nothing more nor less than suggestions. If you have ever received a treatment in which a practitioner said you were merely receiving mental suggestion treatments. You are well, you are God's perfect child, you are spiritual, you are in the kingdom of God, you are this, you are that. Nothing spiritual about those treatments, although there may have been something spiritual about the consciousness of the practitioner, and there was if you received a healing. But the treatment wasn't spiritual, it was mental suggestion. It was another form of what Kuei discovered. Only Kuei said, I am perfect, and I am well, and I am this. But the metaphysician, in addition to often saying I, also says you. You are well, or he or she or it is perfect. Well, that's mental suggestion. If the practitioner goes far enough in that practice, the suggestions can become mesmeric. There was a practitioner in California who, for many years, was quite successful. But she was wrecking her own health and her own life with her practice. And finally she came to me for help and said, what can I do to get free of this? Well, what is the trouble exactly? Well, she said, you know, my patients never know a moment of sickness, except on the days when I don't treat them. Then they're sick. But as long as I treat them every day, they are not sick. But I can't keep it up anymore. Well, of course not. She was directing mental suggestion at him in such a high degree that they didn't have a chance to know whether they were well or sick. They were just suggestionized into, oh, I'm well. But on the days when that mental pressure wasn't on them, they could be themselves and say, oh, I guess I'm not so well. Now, mental treatments can continue to such an extent that they bring one really under the hypnotic spell of those suggestions. And while it all may seem to be well for the moment, it certainly can't last as a permanent dispensation, because hypnotism wears off, mesmerism wears off, the powers of suggestion wear off. That is why in the infinite way we are instructed, never address your patient when you are treating. Never have your patient in your mind. Never permit the name or identity of your patient to come into your thought when you're treating. How are they to get the benefit of it? Well, they asked you for the help, they have made the contact with you. Now, the truth that you know in your consciousness becomes the law unto them. Therefore, it is never the truth when you have you in your treatment. Because the you that you're addressing has just told you they're sick, so how can they be the child of God or spiritual or perfect or immortal? In other words, the human, the mortal, is never immortal or spiritual. It can't be, because the work that we're doing and the study that we have undertaken is to make us die daily so that we may be reborn of the Spirit. What's the use then of telling that which is to die that it's already spiritual? Now then, your treatment, after someone has asked you for help, your treatment consists of your bringing that word God first and realizing within yourself the nature of God, the allness of God, the omnipresence of God, the omniaction of God. And here's where I'm going to go off now to that I started with, that was coming through the law of God. And you may have this come up in your treatments. God, according to Scripture, is the law giver. Since God has nothing to give but himself, the law of God must be as much spirit as God. Therefore, the law of God is a spiritual law. Therefore, since God is infinite and all law is spiritual law. There is no other. Ah, yes, but now here is material law and mental law. Yes, but in the allness of spiritual law, material law and mental law must be of that carnal mind or nothingness and inoperative. You'll find that you have nullified infection and contagion without even mentioning them. You'll find that you have nullified hereditary law, the law of heredity. You'll find that you have nullified laws of food, laws of climate, laws of weather. You find also that you have nullified the Hebrew law of 70 years. I suppose you know that that is one of the most cataclysmic laws operating in human consciousness. We all try to think we're Christians. And then we go back to the Hebrew law of 70 years, like we go back to the Hebrew law of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now, you cannot, as a Christian, if you want to be a Christian, you can't accept the law of 70 years, because the Christian law is, I am life eternal. I am immortal. I was never born and I will never die. That's the whole basis of Christ Jesus' teaching. Now, I want you to understand that I don't accept it as a Christian, because I have never acknowledged that I'm Hebrew or Christian, or Buddhist, or Vedantist, or Taoist. Because my life is lived under the law of God, and it knows no religion, and no sect, and no creed, and no color, and no race. These laws under which we live, and which we're teaching in the infinite way, are universal laws. Some of them were given to the world by Lao Tzu. Some of them given to the world by Buddha. Most of them were given to us by Hebrew mystics and prophets. And a few of them were given to us, and most of them repeated by Jesus Christ and have been embodied in Christianity. For instance, many people believe that the two commandments given by Jesus Christ are Christian. Neither one of them are. The first one is in the book of Exodus, given by Moses. And his second commandment is in the book of Leviticus. Love thy neighbor as thyself. And Jesus, as a Hebrew rabbi, knew these two commandments, and he gave them to us, and they form the foundation of Christianity. But actually, they're not Christian, but neither are they Jewish. Because as you go back into the great Oriental teachings, more especially Egyptian, you find the same two commandments. Just as the Sermon on the, no, the Golden Rule, do unto others as you would have others do unto you, that has been given to us five times in 1,500 years before Jesus appeared on earth. So in obeying the Sermon on the Golden Rule, you are not doing it as a Christian, you're just doing it as a child of God, obeying God's laws regardless of to whom they were given. Now, when you understand that, you come to that place where you break down this middle wall of partition and you are able to say, now I see, there is neither Greek nor Jew. There is neither bond nor free. We are all one in spiritual sonship. And you will find that all of these laws that we consider Judeo-Christian aren't really Judeo-Christian. They come to us long, long before that. Now, when you understand that, you can begin to understand that all law is spiritual law. It's not Jewish law, and it's not Christian law, and it is not Hindu law. Why, the law of karma, which many people believe to be oriental, nonsensical. It appears in the Hebrew scriptures, and Jesus made it one of his major points of religion. As ye sow, so shall ye reap. That's the law of karma. As ye sow, so shall ye reap. Paul repeated it. If you sow to the flesh, you reap corruption. If you sow to the spirit, you will reap life everlasting. And that's karma. Karma means that whatever mode of life you pursue, that is the fruitage you will enjoy. If you are living according to spiritual standards, your life will manifest spiritual freedom, spiritual health, spiritual harmony. If you live in the belief that money is supply, or that the heart gives you life, that's what you reap. That's what will come through. And when the heart doesn't beat, your life will stop. But if you sow to the spirit, you will realize, oh no, my heart doesn't govern my life. My life governs my heart. As long as there is a life, there will be a heartbeat. Now, when you realize that, and you realize the infinite nature of life, you can keep your heart beating as long as you want. Because it has no power to talk back to God. It has no power to talk back to life, except that those living the material life are reaping their acceptance of material law. And the material law says that sooner or later the heart must go. And when it does, you go. So humanity keeps on dying. And even with all of the advances in knowledge, they still seem to keep dying around 70 years, a few years more, a few years less, showing how deeply ingrained that Hebrew law is. And yet it isn't a law, it was just a belief. Just like the law of heredity was originally a Hebrew teaching, a Hebrew belief, that if the parents sinned, it would be visited on the children unto the third and the fourth generation. 200 years later, an enlightened Hebrew came along and said, no more shall ye use this law in Israel. For each individual has to live according to their own deeds. Later on, the original Hebrew law was reinstated in Materia Medica. And so today, we still suffer from the belief that the sins of the fathers are visited on the children. And not only to the third and fourth generation, but they now go much further than that. But you see, that never was a law, or it couldn't have been nullified. It was a Hebrew belief or teaching. These can be nullified when you discover the law. Now, the germ theory is not a law, it is a belief. How can I be so certain of that? Well, for one reason, I have treated people with germ diseases, flu, pneumonia, grip, so forth, and have healed them. Therefore, proven that the germs were not power. Secondly, we have had experiences where, I'll tell you one of them. This is in some of the other tapes, but it'll bear repetition. When I was a practitioner in Boston, my name was registered with the Benevolent Association, and I was an official practitioner up there. And this was one of those February or March months when Boston is inundated with grips and flu and so forth. And I went home one night from my office with 29 cases of those things to care for. Came back to my office the next morning and within a few minutes had five more. But at noon, there was a blank hour on my pad, and I closed my doors and I went into meditation and asked the Father why this blank hour was here. What do you have for me? And the answer came, you do not have 34 cases. You have only one. That is a belief in infection and contagion. But since God is the only creator, if there are any germs, God must have created them. They can't be destructive, and that's that. And before that evening was over, I was virtually clear of those cases, phone call after phone call, to tell me that in that hour they had felt their release. The next morning, when I went out to the Benevolent on a call, the lady at the desk greeted me with the fact that 25% of the staff were down with it, and nearly 50% of the visiting patients. And I said, you know, you're responsible for that. Which shocked her, as you're supposed to be the doorkeeper here. Now, we don't have any bad people for you to keep out. We don't have any drunks or thieves. So what are you the doorkeeper for? You mustn't allow anything to intrude into this place that defileth or maketh a lie. And what is operating here except a belief, an epidemic, a belief in infection and contagion, and you've let it get by you, and it's in this place. Now it's up to you to do the work and get rid of it. Well, you can imagine she was quite shocked, but she knew me well enough to listen. And so together we worked there for a few minutes, and I brought to her attention what I had just had, that we're not dealing with all these people or all these cases. What we're dealing with is there's a belief in two powers, good and evil. There's a belief in infection and contagion as being destructive, whereas there is only one power. All that God made is good, and there is no destructive power. And within 24 hours, that place was cleared. She made the mistake of telling it to the boss, and she got fired. But nevertheless, it took place. Now, we are not dealing with principalities or powers, you know. Therefore, we do not need the power of God to do anything for us. The power of God is already doing that which it's supposed to do. So we do not war with evil. We do not war with principalities or powers. We do not war with bad men. We do not war. We know the truth. And the truth is the infinite nature of God's being. Whether you take it up as life or law or substance or cause or power, each one of those words makes a new treatment. And then, or presence, or love, then you find that you don't address this treatment to your patient. You know it within yourself. What you know becomes the law to those who have turned to you for help. You must remember that you, here as a class, are embodied in my consciousness. Therefore, the truth which permeates my consciousness is a law unto you, as long as you are here as students in this class. Long time ago, I told a class, you're not even permitted to die during this class because we mustn't have the class broken up. In our last class, we had a woman who tried it, but she didn't succeed. Now, always remember this. Your household, your families, your business, if you're a teacher, your scholars, or students, or patients, all of these are embraced in your consciousness. And the truth, you know, becomes a law onto their experience. Of course, there will always be some who will not be receptive and responsive because they are sowing to the flesh. And they do not hold themselves, consciously or unconsciously, receptive to truth. Others who are not definitely antagonistic to the spirit, to the idea of God, or who are not deeply and specifically sowing to the flesh in a personal or definite way, these may be receptive even without any knowledge of or desire for truth. Therefore, you take on a tremendous responsibility because you want everyone within range of your consciousness to show forth the same harmony, joy, life, prosperity that you are having. And there's only one way in which you can help in that, and that is to maintain your consciousness absolutely pure. That means not accepting beliefs of good and evil or of power apart from God. Don't interpret that, as some do, to mean that this is barring human affection from your life. On any level, it isn't. Human affection in our experience is entirely rightful, and at every level, the marital as well as any other. So don't believe that that bars you, for these things are not sin. But when I say purity, I mean purity in the absolute sense that you must be praying without ceasing. You must maintain God as the only presence and power and law, and you must forever be impersonalizing by accepting all appearances of evil, whether they appear as person, place, thing, or condition, throw them out there into the carnal mind and then nothingize them. When you do that, everyone who becomes a part of your consciousness in some measure feels it. Now, I want to show you how far and wide this goes. As I travel, I never talk truth. I never speak about my work or my books. I never enter into any religious conversation except in the line of my work, where I'm asked. It isn't my function to proselyte or to interfere in anyone's life, and if at the moment it pleases them to sow to the flesh, that must be their pleasure. When they're ready for the Spirit, they'll find the teacher or teaching necessary to them. But you do not know how many times things take place when going for rooms in a hotel, or tickets in the airfield, or the handling of baggage, or in many, many different walks of life, where the influence is felt and somebody knows that something has happened, or that there is something different taking place and an attraction is formed. In other words, without knowing why, they know that something is. Now, what is this something? It is the lack of criticism, judgment, condemnation through impersonalization. It is this living in the allness of God. It is not accepting any material or mental power as power. And that leaves a state of consciousness at peace. And anyone who enters that state of consciousness, even with a tiny bit of receptivity, knows that something has happened to them. That is why this message is invited into metaphysical churches and metaphysical centers, because they feel from the contact the peace, even when they don't know why, and even when they don't agree with the principles, they still feel it. So it is that you can always recognize a student when you're around them by that very thing, that there is a peace and a poise that comes because they are not warring with evil. They have found their peace because of the realization that the evils of the world are not power. They're not fearing whether communism comes or not. They're not fearing whether bombs come or not. They're not fearing whether this or that political party gets in power. It is true that they are at work always, knowing that the carnal mind cannot operate, whether in the political field, the governmental field, the educational field, the religious field. Our students must be praying without ceasing to know that the carnal mind, whether in the form of ambition, lust for power, greed for money, has no outlet and no inlet, because it isn't power and it isn't person and it's a nothingness. As you do this, you influence the very politics of your community and ultimately of the nation. Now, there is here a question bearing on this. And the Master speaks, you say, this truth expressing itself as my consciousness becomes your consciousness and the consciousness of those who turn to you. Would this not, in a sense, seem to indicate a sort of thought transference? You see that it doesn't, because I am not directing this truth at an individual. I'm not declaring it to them or about them, or let us say, in this matter of politics. I'm not transferring thoughts to anyone, because I'm not for anyone or against anyone. I'm not for any party or against any party. So I can't be transferring thought to anyone. All I'm doing is abiding in the word that since God is the mind of man, the carnal mind and its activities has no place to function. If that knocks a Democrat out of office, or a socialist, or a communist, or a Republican, that's their hard luck, not mine. I haven't done it to them. They have done it to themselves by catering to the carnal mind, and they've just come up against truth. Heaven help anyone expressing the carnal mind who comes up against those expressing truth, for they have a sad experience, and there's nothing personal about it. No, there's no thought transference unless you are taking your patient into your thought. If you take your patient's name or identity and address your treatment to them, this is transference of thought. But if someone telephones to you, you may know who they are, you may not. I've had quite a few calls here since I'm here from people whom I don't know. Some of them have told me their names and I couldn't remember them even when I heard them. So there could have been no thought transference. I wasn't interested in their identity. I was interested in knowing the truth. And we have the truth now in capsule form. Start with God and be sure that your contemplative meditation or treatment is a full and complete statement of God, God's presence, God's power, God's law, God's life, God's substance, God's activity, God's intelligence, God's love, all of which is individual. Then you are ready for the second step, the appearance. Whether the appearance is person, place, thing, condition, it is an activity of the carnal mind. It belongs to that mesmeric influence which comes to us through the universal belief in good and evil. But since it isn't person or place or condition or thing, since it is only a belief and we don't have the belief, that ends it. Then you have your few seconds or a minute or two in which you turn to the Father, speak, Lord, thy servant heareth, for now you don't wish to voice truth, you wish to hear truth or feel truth or the click or that release. And so you are there for a few minutes until you know that's it. Then you're through. You may have to repeat that treatment a dozen times for some patients. You may have to repeat it for a year, because all are not equally receptive, and in some cases, healings won't come until the patient brings about, or your treatment brings about in the patient, some change of consciousness. Because you see, we are not healers of the body. We can't remove disease. Therefore, always there must be some kind of a change in consciousness which produces the outer effect of healing. There is a reason why at least 50 or 60% of your healings can be complete and quick. That is, because the claim of the patient is not really anything to do with them. It is really something universal, like the belief of infection or contagion or heredity, or something to do with weather or climate or food. It is something of such a universal nature that it has really nothing to do with them personally, except that they are momentarily the victim of it. You find this very often when you get a call for ptomaine poisoning. Somebody has eaten a poisoned food. Now, these healings usually result in 3 or 5 minutes. And the reason is that the patient in no wise enters that case. They have just been the victim of a universal belief, and they're quickly freed of it. The same way, very often, you'll find that at least in half your cases or more, the patient has nothing to do with their ills at all, and as soon as you handle these universal things, they're free. But once in a while, or occasionally, you find that the patient is clinging to some form of belief which they are not at the moment able to surrender. It has become so personalized with them. And in that case, Your treatment may have to continue until they're released from that. And it may be a fear of death. Now, you know, fear of death is a very universal thing, but it becomes personalized. And you'll find that as soon as people start reaching 50s and 60s, consciously or unconsciously, their thinking starts to change in terms of, well, I can't plan for 10 years ahead. Well, I only have, I don't know how many, and so forth and so on. And they have accepted this belief of ultimate death. And sometimes your treatment continues until they awaken one day and say, what am I thinking about? I am immortal, whether I'm here or there. Then you find you have released them. And with others, it's other things of a personal nature. But be sure you don't fasten onto them. Even if it's uncovered to you, don't tell them. And don't tell them that they have to get rid of it. That's just going back into psychology or psychiatry. Whatever is uncovered to you, let it drop as a nothingness, not as a something to be got rid of. Always remember, you have nothing to get rid of. Your patient has nothing to get rid of. All you have to do is know the truth. And the constant knowing of that truth will build a whole new consciousness for you, in which error, regardless of its name or nature, will have less and less power until it has none. Then you have that mind which was also in Christ Jesus. Well, the time has come, my wife tells me, for a little rest.